WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. African-American women activists dealing with issues of race and gender sometimes find they're expected to choose one over the other. My guest, Deborah Gray White, wondered if black women earlier in the century faced the same dilemma. She's written a new book about African-American women's groups through the 20th century called Too Heavy a Load, Black Women in Defense of Themselves. Deborah Gray White is a professor of history at Rutgers University, where she co-directs the Rutgers Center for Historical Analysis. She's also the author of Let My People Go, African Americans 1804 to 1860, and Aren't I a Woman, Female Slaves in the Plantation South. She says that she was inspired to write her new book after watching Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill testifying at Thomas's confirmation hearings.
As I watched them almost do their verbal sparring on day by day on national television, I just wondered, how it was that Anita Hill got herself into that situation. And I felt for her, as I did also feel for Clarence Thomas. And as I say in the book, I felt divided against myself. I felt like I could empathize and sympathize with Thomas because I saw this black man being put on trial for his his sexuality. And then I saw Anita Hill, who people I thought really didn't understand. She came out of a tradition of black women being thought to be sexually promiscuous, and I don't think anyone knew that history.
So what were the questions most on your mind when you started your study?
Well, there were a couple of, there are lots of questions. And one of them was how black women dealt with black men and whether or not there had been the kind of gender tension, the kind of animosity that I saw spark between Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas. I wanted to know when that began and what kind of history there was for it. I wanted to know if black women had come to the black women's defense because I did not see black women coming to Anita Hill's defense. And I also wanted to know what kind of issues. One of the things that I think the Anita Hill-Clarence Thomas confrontation sparked was a discussion between people of the black middle class and the working class. And I wanted to know what kind of issues had sparked people's interest before that.
Your book begins with the African-American women's clubs that began being organized in the 1890s, clubs that led to the formation of the National Association of Colored Women. What issues did these clubs organize around?
Mm-hmm. They organized principally around the issues of race leadership. Originally, Ida Wells Barnett was the person who they organized around. She had gone to England as part of an anti-lynching crusade. And while there, trying to get Englanders to support the anti-lynching crusade in America, she was called by American journalists, one journalist in particular, a promiscuous, licentious woman. And that was sort of the gauntlet that was thrown down, and the National Association of Colored Women picked it up. And one of the things that they organized for was around defense of their name. They wanted people to understand that black women had a history of sexual exploitation, but it wasn't something that they had brought on, that they were respectable women just like other American women.
And you say that a lot of the black women in these organizations and groups at the turn of the century believed that women were more nurturing, more moral, and more altruistic than men. Mm-hmm. They had moral superiority. How did that come into play in the women's groups?
Now, first of all, I think we have to put it into some context because at the time, it's the turn of the century, lynching was at its height. And black people, and meaning by that black men in particular, were being disfranchised. The vote was had been granted with the 15th Amendment, and now it was being taken away. There was segregation, which was being instituted legally for the first time. So here the thinking was is that somehow black men were really not able and in some cases not capable of leading the race. And that black women being more moral, being more altruistic, being more in touch with the real needs of black people, that in fact black women were the salvation of the race, far more than black men.
How did black men react to that idea?
Well, with difficulty, I think. But interestingly enough, there were a lot of men who supported black women at the turn of the century and who thought that black women really could do the job that black men either were not doing or could not doing. And understanding that black men were under siege, many men said, you know, you go right ahead. You write a book of acts for the race. On the other hand, there was a significant number of black men who said, you know, we need our women to act like women.
Give us a sense of what life would have been like for a woman who was active in the National Association of Colored Women in the early part of the 20th century.
Well, I think she would have been married. She might have had maybe one or two children. If she didn't have one or two children, she would have been taking care of some other family member's children. She probably would have worked outside the home as a teacher or as a social worker, perhaps as a nurse. She would have given time to her formal job, but on Sundays and Saturdays and in her spare time, she would have worked with a club. She would have met with them on an annual basis. And more than likely, if she lived in the North, she would have been an advocate for women's suffrage. If she lived in the South, she probably would have been very hemmed in. Her life would have been really, really different from the woman who was an agricultural worker, who was a sharecropper, who worked from dawn to dusk in the fields. She would not have worked in a white person's home, which would have really differentiated her from the masses of black women.
Now, how did the National Association of Colored Women connect with the white women's groups of the period?
No, they didn't connect. In fact, one of the reasons, and just one of the reasons why the National Association of Colored Women was founded, was because the General Federation of Women, which was a white women's group, would not allow them to become members. And they did everything possible in scheming and to make sure that black women did not join, and particularly the very, very light-skinned women who could have passed for white, who were black, who could have passed for white. They made sure that they could not join their organization. So, as a consequence, black women organized in their own racial group.
Let's look at the 1920s. You described the 20s as the age of the new Negro and the new woman. What was new in each of these cases?
Well, the new Negro was signified by a new emphasis on the fight for civil rights. Black men had gone to World War I. They had been soldiers. They had died for the country. There was a sense that they deserved to be citizens in the fullest sense of the term. And what was new with the new woman was that she could vote. And also there was the sense that she was now free to express her sexuality in a way that she hadn't been earlier in the century or in the 19th century. So both the new Negro and the new woman emerged in the 1920s, and they really changed the nature of American life.
How did they change the nature of the black women's groups?
Well, particularly for the National Association of Colored Women. Here was a group that had argued that women were the best leaders of the race. And now black men who had been soldiers were arguing, no, women are not the best leaders of the race. We are. We have died. We fought for this country. There was the Harlem Renaissance movement. Most of the poets and the novelists and the artists of the Harlem Renaissance movement were men. And there was a new militancy that they expressed, and it was about manhood rights. What happened with the New Woman movement is that black women, one of the things that the National Association of Colored Women had always done was to represent black women as really very, very moral, but also really very respectable, and respectable in a very asexual way. But here in the 1920s was the new woman claiming a sexuality and an openness about sexuality that was certainly very new. And so for the National Association of Colored Women to be, first of all, met with men who were going to be militant and who were going to say, women, you have to step back and men now have to lead. For the new woman to come up and say, it's okay to be very openly sexual. The National Association was challenged, and it was challenged on its very, very premises.
You say one of the crushing blows to the women's movement of the 20s was the black nationalism of the Garvey movement.
Right.
How did they come into conflict?
Well, Garvey was a black nationalist, and in arguing for black nationalism, he argued that black people ought to look to Africa, not to America. He argued for sort of a racial purity movement, that black people should stay within their own group, they should buy within their own neighborhoods, and they should marry within their own groups. And black nationalism was expressed in very masculine language. Women became very symbolic in black nationalism as queens and idols. They were symbolically the nurturers of the race. But as far as the leaders, the black nationalist movement was for men and for very manly a representation of the race. And as such, with all these things in mind, Garvey really did crush the National Association of Colored Women, not the least because he argued for racial purity, and so many of the black women who were head of the National Association of Colored Women were very, very light-skinned black people. And, you know, Garvey himself being very dark-skinned and very black nationalist, he did not see women as being adequate or, you know, leaders of the race. He thought that in the international councils, and this is one of the things that he wanted black people to do, black people in America. He wanted black people in America to join with West Indian blacks, to join with African blacks. And in that arena, he saw men as being the primary leaders. And, you know, it's really hard for black women to say no to that. And that, I think, was a really difficult choice. And because the movement was so short-lived, it was a choice that black women really didn't have to make in the 1920s. But who could resist being thought of as a queen, as a goddess, as someone who really didn't have to work, who would be taken care of? Black women who had had such a really long history of working in the fields and in other people's kitchens. You know, Garvey held out this promise that, you know, you won't have to work. We'll take care of you. We will be the supporters. We will be the breadwinners. And you can sit back and you can be on the pedestal in the same way as white women.
My guest is Deborah Gray White, author of Too Heavy a Load. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Deborah Gray White, and she's a historian based at Rutgers University and the author of a new book called Too Heavy a Load, Black Women in Defense of Themselves, 1894 to 1994. And it's a look at black women's groups through the 20th century. Now, you described the 1960s as the era in which America's racial consciousness was masculinized. What do you mean by that?
Well, and at the very turn of the century, there was this phrase that a race can rise no higher than its women. And both black men and black women supported this idea that black women, when they became professionals, again, because black women had to deal with sexism and racism, so that the entire race would rise. But the 1960s, a very crucial change came about, and that was that it was sort of a completion of what had begun in the 1920s, that black men had to lead the race, that that if the family, for example, was to prosper, then it had to be led by men, that men had to make a living wage, that women had to take a step back. And not the least of one of the reasons for this happening was the Moynihan Report that was released in 1965 that literally vilified black women for having had a higher level of educational attainment and for doing better vis-a-vis white women than black men had done vis-a-vis white men. There was this idea that voting rights, that segregation, that men really, as leaders of the race, had to prosper before the race would prosper.
And you're right, too, that there was the sense that that a lot of black women in their activism were being too domineering. They were emasculating black men.
Many men felt that way. In fact, when you looked at, and see, historically, it had been the case that black women could get away with being a little bit more assertive than black men. I mean, lynching was a reality. And black men were perceived to be a lot more threatening. So historically, what had happened was that black women did take a leading role in many families, did take a leading role in speaking up against discrimination. Historically also, black women generally had a higher level of education because in families, the thinking was that if I don't want my daughter to wind up as a domestic worker in somebody's kitchen, then she has to get more education than my son, who can, you know, find jobs that but jobs that won't be as threatening to them, particularly as far as being raped, as far as sexual exploitation. My son can get a factory job or some kind of job. My daughter can't. So families that could bring together money, they put the money into the women's education. But by the 1960s, those facts were taken out of historical context, and when you looked at them, when black men looked at them, when Moynihan looked at them, they said, hey, black women are doing better than black men, and we need to put a stop to this.
Are you suggesting that by putting a stop to it, instead of just like raising the education of black men, black women were pushed down?
Black women were told, and they were told to take a step back.
Do you think we're still there?
I'd like to think that we are not, but I'm afraid that certain events of the last few years have shown that we still are there. For example, when Mike Tyson was released from prison, and he was imprisoned for raping a teenage girl, he was celebrated. And there was this sense that, you know, there was something, there was, you know, that this woman, this girl had done something to him as opposed to him having done something to her. He was seen as a hero. No one seemed to remember why he was in jail. The Million Man March would say that, okay, black men had to atone for well, whatever they had done in the past, and that this was not a time for women to march with black men. And it was a There was a sense that, well, we can't be partners here, that men have to take the lead.
One of the issues you've dealt with in your new book, Too Heavy a Load, is how African-American women activists have dealt with their identity as women and as African-Americans. And I'm wondering if that's ever been a kind of divisive issue for you, if you ever had to ask yourself, well, which am I putting first, my identity as a woman or as a black person, as a black woman? I mean, does this just come naturally, or do you have to, like, think all this through and find that there's little battles waging inside of you?
There are little battles waging inside of me when I'm challenged. Generally, I can't. I mean, there's no way I can divide myself and be a woman on the one hand sometimes and then a black on the other hand. Everything I do, the way I think, has to do with me being both black and female. And when I'm challenged, and then people will say, well, aren't you black? Don't you see yourself as black? And why are you always dealing with women's issues? I say, well, I see things this way because I'm black and female. And I'm also challenged when I say, well, how come you don't identify more with women? Well, I'm a black woman. So even women's issues, you know, they take on, they have different significance than they would be if I were white. During the Hill Thomas confrontation, I was asked to take a side, you know, by friends, by colleagues, you know, who do you side with? And it's like, I side with both of them.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Deborah Gray White is the author of Too Heavy a Load, Black Women in Defense of Themselves. White co-directs the Center for Historical Analysis at Rutgers University.